Welcome to Modern Ancestral Mamas, a podcast for mamas created by mamas. We discuss ancestral food, cooking, feeding our families, and holistic living with the everyday modern mom.
We are Corey and Christine, two mamas on a mission to nourish our families holistically while keeping it real in today's crazy world. Follow us on this adventure and enjoy the stories and information we share.
Welcome back to Modern Ancestral Mamas. I am Christine from Nourish the Littles, and I'm joined by my co-host Corey from For Nutrients' Sake.
And I love that you do that. Makes me laugh.
I always have like a freak out moment. Oh my gosh, who am I? But anyway, today I knew who I was. In today's episode, we're going to be discussing a topic that I actually know absolutely nothing about. I am a complete beginner, and so I'm super excited to learn more about canning. Since I'm clueless on this subject, and I think, Corey, do you know
mostly
a little bit about
clueless.
It? Mostly clueless, too. All right. So this is going to be new for both of us. We decided to bring on today's guest so that she could share her experience and her expertise on canning and pressure canning. Today's guest is Jenny Gomes from The Domestic Wildflower. Welcome, Jenny.
Thanks so much for having me, you guys.
All right. So Jenny, I'm going to read a really quick bio on you, and then we'll launch into the show. All right. So Jenny is a master food preserver, which sounds like epic, mother, wife, teacher, and canning enthusiast. She's the co-host of the popular preserving podcast, Perfectly Preserved, and she writes about all things homemade on her blog, The Domestic Wildflower. A decade ago and pregnant with her first child, she realized she wanted to feed her kids with home canned goodness the way she was raised. Now canning is a part of her cooking routine, and she aims to teach all her readers how to do the same. She makes her home in the mountains of Northern California. She's the author of this new book called The Pressure Canning Cookbook. So sounds like you're the girl to talk to on this subject. Yeah.
Thank you. I hope so.
All right. So we're going to start every episode. Every episode we start with a kind of round table question about the subject of the show. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to round table and ask, what was your childhood? Like, did your childhood include canned food? What do you think of when it comes to that? Jenny, you can go first if you want to.
Okay. So my childhood, I was raised on a cattle ranch, and my mom had a big garden, and she and my grandmother canned lots and lots of different types of fruit and vegetables. My great-grandmother was sure to plant raspberries, blackberries, apricots, peaches, cherries, apples, other fruit. And I just spent a ton of time watching that happen and helping that happen. So I just have a really happy memory of canning. My husband's family were immigrants from Portugal, and his grandmother would drive over the border into Oregon in a pickup and purchase a pickup bed full of peaches. And his father remembers as a kid, his mother having like a real live cauldron of boiling water outside, canning what would essentially be all the peaches they would eat for an entire year. So I just have very happy and productive memories of canning. And it just sort of fits in with like all my summertime memories, I feel like, have something to do with that ends or begins with with canning.
So you also connect it very much with like an emotional
totally
thing.
Totally.
Family, community.
Yeah.
I can go next. I don't think that either of my parents ever canned anything growing up. I ate a lot of foods from cans. I'm thinking of Bush's beans and oh my gosh, what a sloppy Joe's and like
a sandwich.
Yep. Yes, totally. I know. I ate a lot of gross things from cans. My mom recently, though, this is why I'm excited that we're going to talk about this, because I don't know if this is actually canning or not, but she has a pretty big garden and she has started what I think is canning last year, all of her okra. The okra was just, I mean, we had okra coming out of our ears, literally. And so I think she canned it. I don't know if that's what it was or not. But, and then one more comment that I'll make about this is, have you guys ever read the book Blueberries for Sal?
I love that book.
I know. Oh, it's such a good book. And at the end, yeah, the last picture after, you know, mother and Sal have collected all the blueberries is them in the kitchen and they're canning them together. Mm-hmm. So this episode made me think of that book.
I'm glad you brought that up. I love that book. Okay. I did not grow up with my mother canning or anybody in my family that I can remember. The one thing I remember eating from a can, and this is like the metal cans, you know, aluminum cans, is peaches or like a fruit medley thing, mm-hmm. which I always thought was really gross. Mm. And then tomatoes maybe, but I remember very distinctly making those telephone, you know, like a string telephone with the cans.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But I know this is totally different than that. Like, we're not talking about metal cans. But the other thing is that once I got to high school, my best friend's mom did canned like all of their own things, mm-hmm. whatever they grew, whatever they could get from the local orchards and whatever, they canned that. And that to me was kind of mind blowing because I'd never, and you know, in high school, it never had occurred to me that you could do that. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So could you maybe give a little background on yourself?
Sure.
And, how we got to where we're at.
Yeah, so I got into canning first as a kid out of economic necessity. I think a lot of people think that ranchers are just like sleeping on mattresses filled with money, but there's an expression, land rich and cash poor. And as homesteaders, I bet some people mm-hmm. will be able to relate to that expression. So my family canned out of necessity. And then as I became like a high schooler and college student, it sort of left my mind in terms of how I was spending my time. And I just didn't think about it any further until I was pregnant. And then I should have been like painting a nursery like a normal person. But then I almost became obsessed with this idea that like, I would need to have something healthy to feed the baby. Never mind the fact that the baby would be born and would be drinking, you know, milk exclusively for a very long time. But I was really, really motivated to figure out like, oh yeah, I got to learn how to can stuff. I have to figure all this out. And that first winter I canned probably 100 pounds of apples, which you can get to 100 pounds of apples pretty quickly. But I did can a ton of applesauce. And that's where I started realizing that there were some good books out there, but a lot of them were really geared towards canning huge batches. Like I described my husband's grandmother canning a pickup bed full of peaches, like huge quantities. And I felt like at the time, and now I'm a regular school teacher I would say like a normal amount of demands and busyness. And I felt like a lot of the instructions were assuming that you already knew a lot of basics about canning. And then a lot of the books were also geared toward that huge batch. So I just continued learning and canning and had more children and got just more and more comfortable canning all the time. And then I was looking for a Master Food Preserver course to attend so that I would feel super confident in all things food preservation. And I live at the very top of California, which is 5 hours from Sacramento and then 6 hours from Portland, Oregon. So it's really kind of in the middle of not a whole lot other than beautiful scenery. And at around that time, I made friends with my podcast co-host on Instagram. Her name is Anna Cash, and she cans also. And she had completed a Master Food Preserver course through the Cooperative Extension in Utah. And Utah, at least in the West, is surely a mecca for all things food preservation and homemaking. And I ended up going and staying.
Of course they are.
Yeah, of course they are. I mean, and they, I'm here to tell you, their program is so robust and so strong. And I couldn't thank them enough for being so welcoming to an out-of-state attendee like myself. And I stayed at Anna's home. I did the course. It was awesome. And then here we are. I blog about canning and I share about canning and food preservation on the podcast. And I just love sharing it because I think there's so much, one, there's so much misinformation. And two, it can be such an awesome puzzle piece in this life that you, I'm sure your listeners are interested in crafting a healthier life, better quality food. Just, I think it's one of the important puzzle pieces that can really add to that life that we're seeking. But I hope the thing that I bring to the conversation is just really easy instructions and just the real life understanding that some of this that you're doing has to fit while your kids are napping, or it has to fit in just, you know, a couple hours of the day.
Wow, that's really cool. That's a really good point because yes, we are busy and it's important to be able to figure out how to do this in between child rearing and all of the other demands. Can you talk a little bit about the basics? So yeah. Maybe share with our listeners, what are the differences between fermenting, canning, industrial canning, pressure canning, all of that stuff?
Yeah. So fermenting is interesting because fermenting is you're incorporating and welcoming microbiological activity. You want those good bugs to grow. You want them to overpower the bad ones. You want to cultivate an environment that is rich and teeming with life, and it can make more available some of the nutrients that are available in foods, right? And canning is kind of like, I don't want to say it's the opposite, but it is, the idea is that you're putting hot food into hot jars and you are stopping life from growing from growing. You're forcing the oxygen out of the jar with that boiling water or the steam canning or the pressure canning process. You're forcing the oxygen out. You're stopping anything, any other spoilers from getting in. You're killing the bugs, good or bad, that might be inside. And it's like you're creating a snapshot of that time for that particular jar of peaches or applesauce or chicken or whatever it is. You're pausing or stopping that that growth of any activity. Industrial canning, I think, is just important to mention because I think a lot of people think of, if I can buy it off the store shelf, then surely I must be able to do it at home. And the reason it's important to think about that in a different way is the contraptions and the devices that are available in an industrial setting are not available to the home canner. So, for example, it's very common for people, especially in the fall, to want to can pumpkin because every store end cap is filled with cans of pumpkin, right? And pumpkin is...
I have done this and
sure,
you can guess how it turned out.
Well, no shade, right? I mean, we all learn. We're all learning. We're all growing.
Not good. It didn't turn out good.
Yeah, we're all growing, right? We're all learning. So pumpkin puree is one of a few outliers that you should not can either nor in a pressure canner nor in a water bath canner because it's so dense. And the argument that I get back on social media is like, well, if I can buy it in a can, why can't I can it at home? Because you do not have access to the types of, I think the industrial canning setup is like the size of a whole room, right? And it gets much hotter, much faster, and it can penetrate the density of that pumpkin. So if you've listened this far and you want to can some pumpkin, the best avenue for pumpkin is just freeze it, right? Like canning is not the only way to preserve food. It is one of the many ways. And I think it's silly that people get in this idea of like, oh, everything needs to go in a glass jar. It doesn't. You can put it in a freezer. You could freeze dry it. You can cubes of pumpkin, but they turn to be such mush. I do not personally ever do that, and I don't know why anyone would, because it takes a very long time. The product isn't awesome. If you have pumpkin and you want to preserve it, just freeze it. or dehydrate it or freeze dry it. So that takes us to pressure canning. Water bath and steam canning, I like to think of as like, they're like a hot tub and a sauna. The water bath canning setup is like what you would imagine your grandma having, which is a black speckled pot and the boiling water and the jars, you know, getting in and out. That's like a hot tub. Steam canners, which are very popular in some demographics, they've been approved for use since 2015. They're kind of like a sauna. They're an aluminum atmospheric canner, and they are just another way of water bath processing, but it's more like a sauna. It's more steam bath rather than water bath, but they do the same job in the same amount of time. Steam canning is faster for several reasons, and we can talk about that if you'd like, but they are different than pressure canning because pressure canners get the inside temperature inside your jar over 240 degrees, which is critical for killing the bot spore that is very likely to be present, and it prevents it from ever producing its toxin, which would make someone or something that consumed it sick with botulism. And it also kills all the other little food spoilers that could grow. And it is the way to achieve 240 degrees inside your mason jar. And that is that's the way that you know that pressure canning is a sensible thing to do, because you are canning in a pressure canner low acid recipes like meat and beans and plain veggies that don't require that extra high heat. For water bath canning, you can, and once I say this, people will think like, oh yeah, with the water bath canner, with the speckled pot, my grandma made jams, jellies, applesauce, all those things are higher in acid. Fruit typically is higher in acid. Okay. And then the low acid foods that belong in a pressure canning process with the higher heat are chunks of chicken, beef, venison, stews, chilies, Sloppy Joes you mentioned, plain vegetables, plain corn, plain green beans, plain carrots, plain veggies. So those are all low acid. Low acid foods go in a pressure canner because they don't have that acid also helping create an inhospitable environment for the bot spore.
That's interesting.
Does that make sense?
To process some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It had never occurred to me that you could can meats.
Yeah,
which is
you
silly
can
because, like I mentioned, I mentioned at the beginning that I ate from canned meat growing up. So
of course.
Obviously you can.
Yeah. So yeah, I think I want your listeners to hear that all foods have a pH, and high acid ones can be processed in a water bath, and low acid ones require a pressure canner. So one thing that I think
it's
of
easy if you have a chart that tells you the pH of things.
Well, you
oh,
don't
right.
even.
That is true. Yes.
So I made a chart. It's on my blog, and I can send it so you can give it out to your listeners if you'd like. It's actually available on any Cooperative Extension website too. Mine's just as pretty and easy to read. But you don't even have to understand this acid thing. You just have to follow a tested recipe. That's what I think gets a kind of confusing too for new canners, is the idea that like someone else is testing this, and like, what are they testing, and are they trying to get me to spend more money on something? There's just a lot of like smog of conspiracy around it, and it's such old science, and it's done by like nice boring lady food scientists at Cooperative Extensions that are not motivated by anything other than just which method is safest, which recipe requires that extra high heat or not.
Yeah, so this is interesting because we have this homestead now that we're building, or mm-hmm. and so I'm getting into all of this, mm-hmm. and somebody suggested joining like a rebel canning mm-hmm. Facebook group, and I'm like on there, and these people are talking about crazy things. They're like, I don't even know. I mean, it's like half of it's food that I didn't want to eat anyway. But because what I had learned from my best friend's mother in high school mm-hmm. was that, you know, there's very safe things and there's very not safe things. Mm-hmm. And, you can't cross that line and you need to follow this recipe that somebody else has tested. So just to clear it up, an extension office is usually put on by the state, by a university, right? It's usually
I believe that is exclusively and their role.
Yeah. So their job is to help farmers or anybody in the area, mm-hmm. like they'll come out to your house and help you figure out if you have enough space to have cattle yep. or what plants will grow well where you live, yep. this kind of thing. It's a resource that I don't think a lot of people know about.
Correct.
But they do, and they have like classes and stuff you can go take on all sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah. If
usually this is also connected to the local 4-H or like FFA or something.
Right. Right. So if you wanted to seek out your local cooperative extension office, some offices have master gardener programs. They can help with your ranch if you have invasive weeds. They can help with a lot of different things, and it's all free or very affordable help, and it's staffed by university professionals. Mm-hmm. And it's not a for-profit. I mean, our college is for-profit. Yeah, okay, that's like a whole different episode, right? But they're offering free and or very affordable information that most of it is not new, right? Like I've had a lot, like that whole rebel canning ethos. I mean, we could talk for hours about this. Like I've gotten pushback online about like, as if it's like car seats, like the recommendation keeps changing. And that is just flat out false. Many, many things have been tested. And then they're just like, it is not acidic enough. Like raspberries, just the way the good Lord made them, they're always going to be high in acid. Like that's not new. that's not riddled with conspiracy, and no one's making money off of the fact that you can water bath can raspberry jam as opposed to pressure canning it. Right. So I personally only teach methods that are tested, and, I'll be the first to say, yeah, botulism is very rare. We live in a first world nation. The bulk of the 2000-ish botulism cases in the United States are in infants younger than 1 year old who are fed raw honey because they have a naked gut, and they don't have the microbiome to deal with any bot spore that might be present in the honey. So yeah, absolutely. Botulism is super rare. But how many people are canning? How many people are living this homestead life like you ladies? Not that many, right? The numbers aren't there. And of course, the risk is minimal of contracting botulism, but it's not like you have, if you can eat or consume any bot toxin, it's not like, oh, I have a bellyache and I go throw up or I... Botulism poisoning is so serious, and you will require hospitalization if you do not die. I mean, it is so serious. It is shocking to me the number of people that just aren't willing to pressure can something for just to simply completely remove that risk. I can't wrap my mind around it because the consequences are so grave, you know? I don't understand what the thinking is there. So while the risk is very low, I don't really,
okay.
I wouldn't want to risk it personally.
Right. Right. Okay. So then the answer though to that is just that you have to follow this safe, you know.
Approved by a cooperative extension office, published by an author that you trust that follows tested. If you're not sure, you can always Google the thing you want to can plus the search term cooperative extension office. And you'll start to see that most of those recipes are very similar, right? It's very, very similar. The rebel canners are doing things like preserving jars by putting them in the dishwasher where the heat's really inconsistent. It gets hot and it stops and cools down. Or they're canning in the oven where, again, the heat is really inconsistent from left to right, front to back, clicking on, clicking off. That's also inconsistent. And rebel canners also use a water bath canning process, which can only ever be, it can never get over 240 degrees. So I don't understand the thinking with that either. They just, from what I've read in rebel canning groups, they'll water bath can low acid things for a very long time. But if we know that the bot spore is thermophilic and can only be killed at a high temperature, I don't really see the conspiracy there. I don't see who's like, what corporation is making money off of you putting in a pressure canner versus a water bath canner. You know what I mean? I don't get it.
Okay. So then what do you do if you've got like, you know, this, say a tomato sauce recipe that's handed down from your Italian grandmother and you'd really like to can it, but you know, this is exactly how grandma made it. And it needs to be made this way or it's not going to be right.
Right.
But it's not necessarily a tested recipe. Is that, do you just go, oh, I can't do this. Like I need to pick another way of preserving it or.
No, I would shudder to think that anyone's Italian grandmother would roll over in their grave. That's not what I'm here for. So what I would say is look at grandma's recipe and then search up a tested recipe. And I would be willing to bet they are nearly the same. Okay. And if they're not, tomatoes are super interesting. And I'm going to go off on a little rabbit trail after this sentence here on tomatoes. It's very likely that you'll be able to find a tested recipe that is very, very similar to grandmother's. The ingredients that make grandma's recipe delicious very likely are low acid vegetables like garlic and onions. So you'll want to look at the amount of garlic and onions in a tested one versus the one in grandma's jar or grandma's recipe. And also be open to the idea that maybe I just make this just like grandma did, but with less garlic and onions. And you can always add that at the reheat or add it when you're browning your meat for the spaghetti sauce. I think you just need to be open to a few small modifications. The other thing that a tested canning recipe will have you add is the addition of an acidifying ingredient, which likely will be citric acid. So that bumps up that acid level to a safe level so that you can add all the garlic and onions that grandma included that make it so good. I mean, who doesn't love garlic and onions? I understand wanting to include that, right? So I would challenge you to look at a tested recipe.
Is there another?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Two questions. One, is there another option for not like, can you, is there something you can use other than citric acid? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of us are going to be
not into that,
not interested in citric acid.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's,
yeah,
you know, there's some
problems,
information that it's not great.
Sure.
And then the second question is that, are there things that you can adjust in a tested canning recipe? Mm-hmm. That would like, what is safe to adjust and what is safe not to
adjust?
Those
are great questions.
Like herbs or.
Sure. Great. You know. Okay. Great question. So let's talk about the citric acid or the acidification, right? Tomatoes. This is my tomato rabbit trail. Okay. So keep me on track here. The tomato rabbit trail was going to say most people think incorrectly that tomatoes are high in acid. I think because Americans consume a lot of tomato products that give you indigestion, like tomato sauce like pizza late at night. They're actually, because of years and years of breeding to make them red and big and sliceable and amazing and shippable across the world, they're much less acid than when grandma was making her Italian sauce. Okay. So when grandma and great grandma were canning their delicious tomato sauce with garlic and onions, the tomatoes she had access to were much more acidic than what you and I can grow. Even if it's heirloom, even if we grow it in the best way we can, it's still going to be less acidic than 50 years ago. So that is an unfortunate reality that I don't have a great way to get around that. That is a fact because they're big and red and sweet, right? They're much less acidic than they used to be. That said, most tested canning recipes will call for the addition of an acidifying ingredient. Citric acid is popular because you can get it in the store and it's easy. The dosing is simple, but you put a quarter teaspoon in every jar and you put the lid on. It's very simple. If that is not something you're interested in using, you can use lemon juice. And it is recommended that you use store-bought lemon juice because it will have a standardized acid value. So just like with tomatoes, you know, some lemons will be a little bit less acidic.
Just a jar of it.
Yeah, which I know is not awesome. Like, we don't love to do, to, you know, I don't love that either. The third option for an acidifying ingredient is vinegar, which
I don't know. It's easier than.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it can be. Yeah. Yeah. So you can choose. You can make a choice. And most good canning recipes will give you the options, like either a quarter teaspoon of citric acid or a tablespoon of lemon juice in the jar. Or you can use vinegar, which, again, it's best if you use a store-bought version because it's standardized. We know how much acid is in those jars or in a jar of vinegar. So I think.
And then you're talking about like a white vinegar, not like an apple cider or something.
You can get crazy and do apple cider. You can do like Bragg's with the mother. You can do balsamic. You can, as long as it has that 5% acid value, the acid is what you want.
Okay.
We're choosing a palatable vehicle for acid or one that aligns with our food values, right? So if citric acid is out, okay, fine. Choose a lemon juice that is a brand that you trust and support, or a vinegar that you, but both need to be, or anything needs to be of the 5% acid, which is most on the store shelves in America.
Okay. Right.
And cool. Then,
okay. That's really good.
Yeah.
To know.
Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned tomato sauce because it's one, it is the number one canned food product in America, tomatoes, right? And they are just very tricky because we have this false idea in our mind, many of us, that they're really high in acid, but they're not. Which means you need to add an acidifying ingredient, which, you know, brings into question, like, what, which one do I use and do I have to? And the answer is yes. I would strongly suggest you do so, but you do have some leeway with which ingredient you choose. And then you had a second question and it's, I've forgotten it.
Yeah. I'm curious if you can adjust the amount of like herbs or spices or something like that in a recipe, and if that messes up the
pH.
pH.
Great question. So in the canning process, typically the amount of green herbs that you would add won't change the pH, but they don't love the hot tub. They get pretty smudgy and they don't look beautiful anymore. And I think a lot of the flavor value is lost. So I don't personally think that's a great, I mean, you can include it, but if it's cilantro or basil, they disappear and the flavor is sort of not what you would hope. I have come to love adding a drop or two of essential oil. And whatever merit that oil has after the canning process is unknown to me, but the flavor is bang on. So if you had like, let's say a salsa recipe, that's a tested salsa recipe, but you miss that like cilantro flavor, then I would explore either adding a fresh once you open the jar or using an essential oil. Tomato sauce, like little leaves of oregano, just like you just don't get the flavor canned. So I've added a drop or two of oregano and been very happy with the result. And then adding other types of ingredients, adjusting other things. This tip is from my podcast partner, Anna. She uses dried spices. She uses Sonoran Spice Company for medium hot to crazy hot dried powders, which don't affect the pH and just give a major boom in terms of flavor. She adds them to like pineapple jam to make a spicy habanero pineapple jam. And I think that's a really genius way that you can add a spice or a flavor, which is from a low acid vegetable. But because it's dried and intensified in its flavor, you can add that without worry.
So you can pretty much add any amount of dried herbs or spices and not be
that's
concerned.
Typically correct. Yeah. Yeah. I can't think of an outlier, so I would say yes.
Okay.
I would say yes.
But it sounds like it's pretty easy to just add in the fresh version once you open it up and you're going to use it.
Yeah.
So that's another option.
Yeah. Of course, it's like handy just to open a jar that has everything in it. But for many canning recipes, to bring them to the table, I personally would just add, like I said, with a salsa recipe, I would just chop up a little, if you want the cilantro, because you're not going to can it and have it be the same. It's just very, like, the heat just boils it away to nothing.
I really wanted to ask about, so you talked a little bit about the difference between canning and fermenting, but why would someone want to can versus ferment? That's what I'm really curious.
Yeah. So I would not say it's a versus, it's a and. I would, if you're a person who's fermenting right now, I think that canning is like it's a more science-y best friend. There's a lot more rules, I guess, with canning, but that doesn't mean it's any less valuable. I think canning is great for many things, and creating shelf-stable pantry staples and delicious things to serve your family is really, really valuable. And you can't, well, I mean, maybe you can ferment everything, but there's a lot that you can't. And I think it just is another, like I said, another piece of the food preservation puzzle that just can give you more variety and a shelf-stable option that, like, I think fermenting is awesome, but it does require like a check-in, I guess, right? Or like, okay, is it done yet? Do I need to adjust this? Is everything submerged under the brine? Is it done yet? The daily check-in. But once you're done canning, you can put it on the shelf and not think about it ever again until you're ready to eat it, which is kind of nice. So I think it just is a different piece of the food preservation puzzle. Not a versus, not do one or the other, but try both.
So I from my experience, right, things that I have canned that I would not ferment are things like bone broth, tomatoes from our garden, applesauce, jam. Mm-hmm. You know, these are things that I'm not going to ferment, but I still want to have them preserved from our harvest. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
This might seem like a silly question, but just like clarify for me. So once something has been canned, it can sit on the shelf.
Correctly canned food fine. Can be preserved indefinitely. Is preserved indefinitely.
Correctly canned.
Yeah. So
okay, does it need to be in a room of a certain temperature?
No. So what I think is valuable to remember is those glass jars are clear, which is great. And they are clear because before you open it, you need to be looking at it and thinking, like, does this look like other jars of peaches I've canned? And is there anything weird growing? Do I have lava coming out the top? You know, occasionally you will have had a little misstep in the canning process, but those things are visible, right? I think that it's very important to know that if you can something correctly, it is safe indefinitely. Peaches are a great example because they're sort of soft and sort of delicate. And like 5-year-old canned peaches are pretty soft. They're kind of brown. They get kind of stringy. They're safe to eat, but like, would you want to eat that? Maybe not. You know what I mean? So the quality will go down in terms of palatability and texture just because of light degrading what's inside. But if something is stored in a dark, cool pantry, easily 5 years. I mean, I eat stuff that's older all the time, which is only anecdotal. But the science says that if it's canned properly, it can be safe indefinitely.
Okay. That's good to know. Just because I was thinking, you know, me personally, okay, so if I start canning, where can I store this? I don't have a root cellar or anything like that, but I have a garage.
But you live in Texas.
Exactly. I live in Texas and my garage gets to be 120 degrees. So, and then you mentioned something about light, which, you know, just what we know alone about, fats, for example, we know that light and oxygen and heat can, denature the molecules in, you know, certain fats and stuff like that. So I imagine that light, like you mentioned, could denature the, you know, the molecules in the food that you're preserving. So that's good to know. Okay.
So
that's actually a really good question. I'm curious now that, because you brought up, Jenny, did you want to say something to that?
I just wanted to affirm the thought that that's certainly possible. I don't know enough about the denaturization process to comment with expertise on that particular point. But while I love real raw milk and whole butter as much as you gals, the high fat foods typically are not safe to can for a completely different reason, because the fat climbs the sides of the jar and inhibits a seal formation. So typically, you're not going to have a whole lot of fat in a canning jar anyway, which doesn't directly answer your question, but I thought it was a relevant point that so let's say you're canning any of your homestead meat. Any set of directions that are trustworthy will tell you to trim the fat. And I don't ever mean to say throw the fat away, but you would reserve it for another purpose. It's not at home in a canning jar, just because it definitely during the canning process climbs the sides of the jar, slides out over the top, and inhibits a good seal.
See, this is what I was going to ask you. So you would not be able to can something like lard, mm-mm, like rendered lard or tallow or something like that.
Correct. I would preserve it
big time. No.
Well, big time waste, right? Like, how precious is that for you? If you are going to the trouble of rendering your own lard, you're not going to, I would not think that anyone would want it to go in a process that is going to render it likely to spoil. That seems so foolish to me. Put it in the fridge like you normally would.
That makes sense.
You want to can things
that makes sense
that can fit in your pantry shelf. And it sounds like at least Christine doesn't have a ton of pantry storage, which is great. That's very normal, right? But you're going to can a few jars of a few things that can hang out where it's not super bright and probably not 120 degree Texas heat. But if you're canning in the winter and it lasts you 6 months till spring, I'm not sure that that's a bad idea either. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, right now that it's not hot, I have, I do actually have some food stored in the garage.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have to find a different place for it as soon as it starts getting hot.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, what were you going to say?
No, go for it.
I was going to say, okay, new to canning, never done it before. What do I need? Where do I start?
Okay.
Give me the basics.
The basics. Okay. So you have to decide the thing that you want to can, because that's like choose your own adventure, right? Those are two separate paths. Why don't you give me a real life example of what you might want to can for real, and then the example will fit for you.
Blueberries.
Okay. Can we say blueberry jam or just plain blueberries? Either is fine. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Blueberry lemon jam is pretty great. Okay. So blueberries are high in acid. The flavors that you would put with blueberry are also high in acid, whether it's vanilla or it's lemon or other citrus. Blueberries are great. Okay. They're great for jam making. Tons of safe recipes out there. Tons of them to choose from. So you would process in a water bath or a pressure canner. And if you were brand new and you don't have any canning stuff, here's what you would do. You would get a stock pot, like one that you would boil an artichoke in or boil pasta in, just a stock pot. You would get a silicone trivet. If you have one of those are really great, because you could set it in the bottom of your regular old pot. You don't have to go buy the speckled one. And that keeps your glass canning jars from rattling around and breaking. If you don't want to go that route, and let's say your mother-in-law or whomever has a black speckled pot, then you're going to use that as long as it has the rack that prevents the jars from rattling on the bottom. Then you need to have...
Yeah, because you don't want them sitting on the bottom, right?
Because what'll do is they'll rattle around
and you called crack. It a silicone
trivet. Like a silicone mm-hmm. trivet, like you can get a blossom shape one if you already have that. I mean, I'm all for thrifting things. I feel like you could find those things pretty affordably. Then you need glass jars that are designed for canning. Ball, Kerr, Kilner, those are readily available brands. And WEC, you can also can in WEC jars, which are... They look French to me, and I feel like they're very classically Western European, but they're actually a German company. You can also water bath can in those jars. Those are the jars with the clips and the reusable rubber flanges. You can use reusable canning lids. One brand that's popular is called Tattler, and those are good quality. Or you can just use the regular mason jar style two-piece lid where it's a ring and then a flat lid. It's important that you use a new lid, which is not everyone loves. But if you're going to go to the trouble to making this delicious blueberry jam, you want to have a lid that's going to have a seal that lasts. So do not use a reused lid. If you don't love regular two-piece lids. I mean, the box says there's no BPA, but if you don't want to use them for a very good reason, then my next best suggestion is WEC. The glass is the only thing that's coming in contact with your food, and I found them very easy to work with. So you could use the WEC style jar. And then you need a funnel, and the funnel prevents your blueberry jam from touching the top edge of your canning jar. It prevents it from getting right here, which you don't want anything on here because that will prevent that seal from forming. And I mean, a regular kitchen ladle, and then you're ready to rock and roll. That's what you need to get started. And then you would make your jam. You would have your canning pot right next to you with your jars warm in warm water. There's a lot of on the other side of the rebel canning spectrum is like the nervous Nellies who want to boil everything before they boil it, which is a very positive error. just because it ends up wasting a lot of time. So if you're
this was my mom.
Yeah, and that's
this
great.
Summer actually.
That's great. That's great. So if your total time at the end of the recipe where you're it's processing, where it's in that boiling water, it's in the hot tub for more than 10 minutes, you don't need to sterilize anything beforehand because that's what's happening in the process. So if you're canning at sea level or below 1,000 feet, some recipes, you will probably have to boil your jars beforehand because the total time that they need to be boiling to be sterile is 10 minutes. I live above sea level. I live at 3,000 feet. So I have never once in my life canned something for 5 minutes. Everything has a little bit longer processing time for me because of my elevation. So if you just look at the end of the recipe and think, is the total time these jars are in the hot tub, is it longer than 10 minutes? That's what you're looking for. If it's more than 10 minutes, then you don't need to boil. But maybe your mom was a boiler because you're at sea level.
Yeah. Yeah, we're at sea level. I don't know how long she had it in the pot for, mm-hmm. but.
So that's a great little thing that hopefully will save some people some time. So you'll make your jam. Your jars will be hot. You'll take one jar out of its little hot tub soak there and empty the water from it. You'll place it on a towel-covered countertop so as not to shock the glass with a cold counter. You'll put the ladle in the jar. You'll ladle your jam into it. Your recipe will have something called a head space, and that means the distance from the top of the jam to the top of the jar probably will be a quarter of an inch for most jam recipes. Then you'll apply your lid, either the WEC or the two-piece ball lid, and you'll put it back in its hot tub, and you'll repeat with all the jars, and then you will bring it up to a boil. And once it is at a full boil with 2 inches of water covering the top of the jars, you'll process for however long your recipe calls for, probably 15 minutes for blueberry jam.
It sounds simple. It sounds simple, but yet also there. I feel like there's a lot of utensils that you need to be able to do it well or correctly. I don't know. But I guess once you have all of this stuff, you can just, you know,
mm-hmm.
do it again.
Well,
again
once you have... I think the thing that you may not have, like probably everybody listening to your podcast has a pot, doesn't have to be the canning pot, just a pot. You would just need some sort of rubbery or it can be a metal trivet, like a round. I think Instant Pots come with little metal like racks, don't they? So you could use that. You could use that. It doesn't have to be silicone.
Yeah, they do.
So you could, I feel like I'm like a tiny bit too old to have an Instant Pot. But maybe I'm just like a big nerd and I don't have one. But but you have any kind of rack in the bottom. And then just getting your jars and lids. That'll be like a thing that you'll have to figure out. And then probably a funnel. But plenty of your fermenters have funnels. Or if you have a milk cow, you have a funnel, probably.
Yeah. And we have jars. Jars upon jars.
Right, right.
No, I have so many jars. But the lid thing, yeah, that's good to know because since I have so many jars, I have tons of lids, but they're all used lids. So yeah. I would need to get new lids for
yeah.
But you can buy just lids. Just the flat lid. You don't yes. even have you don't have to use a new ring correct. Every time, right?
Correct. Correct.
Wait, okay. Actually, let's clarify on the lids real quick, because let's say I have a Bell Mason jar and there's two types of lids. I've seen the plastic lids.
Which you would not use for canning.
Yeah, those are the reusable ones.
Right. Mm-hmm. You would not. Okay, so you would not use that for canning. Correct. And then I've seen the metal lids, like you said, the two-piece metal lids.
Yep.
And you're saying those metal lids need to be brand new every time you're canning something.
The metal. But
just the thin round one, not the ring.
The thin flat.
Is that correct?
Yes, you're correct. The thin flat, because you're saying it's a two-piece lid, right? The ring, the thing that you twist, you can be reused for decades as long as it doesn't rust. The flat part,
okay,
you buy brand new. And that's like in here in California, it's $3 a box for a dozen. I have used, side note, I have used.
That's interesting. I didn't even know that you could buy those separate.
Yeah. Yeah. In the, like in my grocery stores, it's in the same aisle, like adjacent to the baking aisle. You know, it's not in the center of the store. It's kind of on the edge. But, I have used lids that I found like at a yard sale just kind of as a test, and they didn't seal. So don't waste your time with that. Just get new ones. Or again, if you object for whatever reason to using that type of lid, the Weck jars are so beautiful and they eliminate that concern about like, do I want this type of canning lid? They work pretty great.
Yeah, I think I've heard people say too that the Weck jars have been tested and they don't have any heavy metals in them and stuff like that. So they're supposed to be like the best jars.
It's the only problem you'll find is that like you don't have 100 of them already. It's just sort of, they're just less common. So you'll have to go buy them and then you only have those six, or they're just not as common in the fabric of American pantry life, I guess. That's the only drawback, I think.
Are they more expensive, just out of curiosity?
Now I don't know that they're...
I would assume.
They're not a lot more because regular jars have gone up. So you would be... That's what I'm saying. You're going to be paying full price. You're going to probably buy them new unless you happen to find them used on Facebook Marketplace or something. That's the thing. You can get used regular ball jars all day long.
That's a good idea.
But if you go Weck, you probably will be investing in new ones. So... I don't know that they're dramatically more expensive. I think it's just that you are going to be forced to buy new.
Yeah, I'm looking online out of curiosity, and you can – I did not know this. You can buy them at Crate and Barrel and Williams Sonoma. And
ooh, fancy.
I know. So one 26-ounce Weck canning jar is $6 at Crate and Barrel.
Well,
Ooh, that seems like a lot.
But you're not going to buy it at Crate and Barrel.
I don't know how much jars are, though. No, I know. You would never do that. I know. Even Amazon says they carry Weck jars.
So yeah, because of the weight of jars, I think buying them online is – I would ask for them at – or look for them in a feed store situation or, dare I say, a big box store.
Oh,
like getting
smart.
Them shipped to your home. Like Amazon canning jars are so expensive because they're coming from a bazillion miles away. They are heavy. I would – maybe shipping from Weck themselves, just Weck, you know, Weck.us or whatever they're at. I don't know their URL off the top of my head, but I would get them there. And I have had a great experience with just Weck themselves. And they're so pretty. I mean, it just feels like the extra layer of.
No, yeah. I know. I'm looking at these. These are gorgeous jars. Yeah. I want one.
They're beautiful. They really are.
But yeah.
And they're easy to stack. So even if you, let's say you get them and don't can in them, they're very stackable. If you choose the style that aren't the tulip, right? The tulip, obviously you can't stack, but they're also easier than standard ball or canning or ball or Kerr or Mason because they don't have the shoulder. If I could go back, I would never bring a shouldered canning jar into my home ever again because it's just... The dishwasher can't get the shoulder clean. It's one more step for you to wipe. It is just – I've been without a dishwasher for a long time, and I've come to wish I had never brought a shouldered canning jar into my house. It's just one more thing to do. We've got plenty of other things to do.
Speaking of stacking, you can't stack canned food, correct?
So after it's canned, what's actually best, and I wasn't raised doing this, but there is, it is best to remove the ring once the jars are cooled, it's labeled, remove the ring entirely and set it on the shelf. It is best to not stack it because if there was a problem or a mistake inside and you're growing some sort of like food spoiler that's going to create a volcano, that lid will lift and you'll be able to see it immediately. But if that ring is on, holding it on, it's, you've got that cooking inside, that little bit of something, like let's say you didn't process it for long enough or the power went out or God, who knows, right? If you had some sort of problem inside, you wouldn't see it. And I've been canning a lot for a decade. And I've had like maybe two jars like lift. And what I think happened was I had a little bit of food on the edge of the jar that inhibited the seal from forming. And then a little bit of oxygen gets in and a little bit of something. And then it, so it is best to not stack. However, do canners stack their jars? Yes. Of course you do. I mean, do you have, it's very hard to have a pantry where you're not.
Can I ask one more question, Corey?
Any others.
Okay. So our audience is familiar with Dr. Weston A. Price, and he talks about the displacing foods of modern commerce, which he mentions are refined flours and sugars, and he actually mentions canned foods.
Sure.
So I'm curious just what your thoughts are in relation to Weston A. Price, his condemnation of canned foods.
Sure. The teachings of Weston A. Price that I'm the most familiar with are his baby formula recipes. And when my kids were babies, I had a nightmare with breastfeeding. I actually used their recipe and I have two healthy, allergy-free, wonderful children. So thank you, Dr. Price. but that said, I would never blame anybody for wanting to avoid just the grocery store aisle tin cans of food. There's so many different types of problems with that. But I would be, it's my personal philosophy that if you go to a U-Pick or you forage or you pick apricots or cherries or whatever, and you wash them and you have a pretty good idea of where they came from and you process them, how in the world could that not be more virtuous than the grocery store tin cans? I don't think that you could tell me that they're not more virtuous. At least, at the very least, you have firsthand knowledge of what's inside. And even if you're making that blueberry jam and you did add plain white sugar, right? Even if you did, that you had the knowledge, the firsthand knowledge that you can trust of exactly how it was processed. And you know, you asked about fermenting at the very beginning, and fermentation is such a rich source of so many different nutritional benefits. But I think a person would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater to say that because canning doesn't have that alive component, that it has no place on your pantry shelf. I think it's a partnership and it's another puzzle piece to any person who's interested in having more homemade food available. That's how I got really into pressure canning, because to me, pressure canning is the intersection of modern, like a regular person who has to take her kids to soccer practice and has a job and her husband works. And we've also got the homestead. We've like having all the things going on. Pressure canning is the intersection of where a regular busy person can feed homemade food to their family quickly. To me, it is the place where that intersects. So if you are able to, let's say on your homestead, you're processing chickens or meat birds or rabbits or whatever the case may be, if you are doing it, you have firsthand knowledge of exactly how that animal was raised, and you're the one who's browning it. And then you're going to put it in the jar and you can season it how you like with the good quality salt that you want or whatever you want to do. Having that available as like a quote unquote fast food or a faster food or a like fast, slow food, however you want to label that, in my mind, that is a very virtuous thing.
It seems to me like there's also a difference between the industrial, you know, the industrial foods of that era, because he was in the 1930s, right? So we're talking like Ovaltine,
right?
And, you know, Tang. These things that were called, you know, good for you mm-hmm. foods that would have come from a can that were not. I mean, there's such a big difference between canned foods at the industrial level and jarred foods, you know, that you're using from your garden or from the local orchard.
Yeah.
And there are things that, you know, you can't ferment some vegetables or fruits throughout the whole season. Like, they're not going to last the whole season. Mm-hmm. At some point they will get gross. It'll get slimy or something, you know, but
right.
So I don't know. I do think that there's a balance between those two. And I still do a bunch of fermenting, but I'm also, you know, canning, specifically tomatoes are like the big thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, it could be that you want to have a conversation about, well, tomatoes are a summer fruit and that's, you shouldn't be eating them in the winter, but that's like an entirely different conversation, you know, and who's really truly doing that?
Well, and also, I mean, the human species has been preserving food in some way since, you know, the dawn of time, essentially. And I guess I am very new to canning because we know that fermenting dates back like thousands and thousands and, you know, millions of years. Okay. Mm-hmm. But canning is relatively new. I saw online the first, at least newer. Yeah. The first industrial canning started in like 1812, something like that. And I'm trying to think, would the early pilgrims, for example, have canned food?
Napoleon.
And even earlier than that, I don't know.
War is the mother, of invention. And Napoleon offered some huge financial prize to anyone who could figure out how to get food to his troops that were a long way from wherever the food was, right? So that was the birth of canning in glass jars. And I can't, forgive me, long gone French scientists or French prize hunters. They were looking to get a financial prize. They figured out how to do it. So while that is kind of an ugly backstory, I don't see how a person could argue that it is anything. It bears such little resemblance to tin cans in the grocery store shelf. To me, they're nothing alike. Nothing the same.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And actually, Corey, you mentioned something about eating tomatoes in the wintertime. And I just, going back to what humans have been doing, we have been preserving food. So yes, you would be eating summer foods or spring foods in the winter and fall if you found a way to preserve them.
They'd be sun-dried, sure. Probably. Yeah. They would have been dried, I would presume. And in terms of like just remembering, I think canning was relegated for a very long time to the activities of the poor, right? I think that people who were canning, you know, when my mom was young, those were poor people, right? And when I was a kid, I'm 40 just this year. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, only people who were poor were canning. So I think there's a whole economic layer to this that is worth exploring. And I think it can be a huge financial win for people to know how to preserve in a variety of ways. And canning's entry point price is very low. Freeze drying is the highest price point in terms of entry point for preservation. But yeah. It's sort of it's like this weird flip-flop. I'm a public school teacher, okay? So I think a lot about poverty and its intersection with food and the types of foods that I see kids eating for lunch, like just the poorest kids that you just know their families have nothing and they're eating a bag of the junk, like Doritos for lunch. It just, it's so awful, right? But if we could tip that back where it is normal and has some sort of social acceptance for people who are on a tight budget to be canning again, I also think that would be a huge win. But I know when I was a kid, it was only poor people that were canning, right? Because that was coming out of the 80s where like TV dinners and processed everything, imperial margarine, that's where it was at, white bread, right? So if you had any disposable income, you weren't doing poor people canning. And I just wish that more people knew how to can, because that could be a financial win for them and then a huge nutritional win as well.
Couple more questions. But the first one is, since we were talking about Dr. Price's work, and one of the big things that he was talking about was the sugar content of foods. And I know that oftentimes fruit preservation via canning has a lot of sugar. So, and it's almost always said, you know, you have to use the white sugar. Is there a way either around using white sugar, or is there a way to reduce the amount of white sugar?
Fantastic question.
And, you know, can we use like sucanat or honey or something like that? Or
Yeah. I want to know the same thing.
So yeah, great questions. So if anyone has ever, any of your listeners has ever found a gummy bear under your car seat from 10 years before, you'll know that sugar is a very powerful preservative, right? Very powerful preservative.
Right.
However, there's tons of safe canning recipes that have no added sugar. My sister is actually a prolific canner, and she is really, really thoughtful of the types of sugars that she includes or doesn't include in her canned food. And what she does all the time is she cans plain high acid fruit, either in fruit juice that she either has juiced herself or just was able to purchase it from a brand that she trusted, or in plain water. And then she just has jars of fruit. Is that like the most exciting thing to put on a bagel with cream cheese? It's a little, it's just not as sweet, right? It's not what many kids are eating at lunch at the public school lunch table. It's not as sweet. However, there's tons of recipes that, or sets of directions rather, for plain fruit and or fruit mixtures that don't call for the sticky, sticky, sweet, plain white sugar. There's lots of sweeteners that are tested to be safe. Honey ends up tasting sweeter in the canning process, I have personally found. So you can reduce the sugar, but just remember your jam won't be quite as thick. There's going to be a textural change. You mentioned at the very, very beginning, Corey, the canned fruit cocktail of everyone's youth, right? You can can chunks of pears, cherries. I did this when the kids were little. I should do it again, but they're getting bigger. You know how their kids want different things. I did tons and tons of canned fruit cocktail, and it was chopped peaches, chopped pears, and halves of or diced up cherries I did. And the syrup, you know how it used to be like heavy, heavy syrup, so thick that you could like frost a cake with it. You can do, it's called like ultra light syrup, and it's such a small amount of sugar. You could do it with honey too. It's just like a little bit of sweet liquid that it's in. So there's lots of options, I think, for, in fact, so many more than I think that you're assuming. You don't have to use plain white bleached CH or whatever brand that is sugar. You can use other kinds of sugars and you can cut back. It's just, you just have to bear in mind it's not going to last for quite as long, and the texture may be different because you're not having that super, super heavy sugar content.
Okay, so that's really good to know, because that is one of my big things with canning. Yeah. Like, it's got so much sugar in it.
Yeah, it does.
And I don't want to use that like white sugar.
Right. Yeah. So
like at all.
So one recipe, if you're if you have a listener that's like, okay, I'm gonna can like immediately, a great one is applesauce, because you can just can plain apples with nothing other than a little water to get the boil going. And you can church it up and make it way fancy. You can add everything from a few tablespoons of whiskey to vanilla beans to spices to other things, but it can be just apples.
That's how I got, I did that years ago, actually. I did a whole bunch of apples that we had picked and we made applesauce, and it was awesome and it lasted a long time. And then I just like didn't do any more canning for a long time after that. Until we moved out here, and I was like, oh my gosh, we have like stuff I need to preserve.
Right. Right.
All right. So I wanted to, I think we have a couple more questions. One is, canning you can can beans and stuff, mm-hmm. right? You can be beans, meat, bone broth. Mm-hmm. I have a question about, you know, if you've got a recipe for something where you are cooking the onions and the garlic and stuff mm-hmm. like that in butter or lard mm-hmm. or something beforehand, and then are you going to mess up your amount of so don't do that.
So sorry, I shook my head, which certainly meant no. But what I should have done was nod yes. You can cook onions and garlic or brown your meat. That's actually a pro tip I always want to mention about pressure canning, is browning your meat before putting it in the jar has such better taste and it looks so much better than raw packing. So browning or sauteing in butter or oil is fine. I would err on the side of a touch less, you know, you just don't want it to be super oily, because the thing that'll happen is the lid won't seal. And that is a bummer. That's the opposite of the whole point of you learning how to do all this. So I would just, you know, try to do a little, go on the light side in terms of what oil you're browning in. And then that little bit that's on the outside is not going to pose an issue. And there's tons of tested pressure canning recipes that tell you to brown in butter or oil or whatever your fat of choice is.
Okay. All right. So, and if you're doing something like beans, would you mm-hmm. put them in, you know, because the way that we make beans is we would soak them overnight with baking soda and water. Yeah. And then we would, I pressure cook them with a bit of seaweed and maybe some bone broth. But if I was going to can them so that, you know, I had them just so on hand for easy, because otherwise this is a long process, right? So yeah, what would be that process? Would you put them in the jar dry?
No, you would soak them overnight. And in fact, a ton of the recipes that I included in my book, it was like I was soaking more beans than I've ever soaked in my life. I would soak and then can the next day and then soak. I was just including tons because there's so many good ways to use them. So you would soak them overnight, and then many, many canning recipes will have you just cook it as if you're going to cook it and eat it for supper right then, right? So you brown the meat. It doesn't have to be cooked all the way through, or you'll get your recipe to where it would be pretty close to being ready to serve. Maybe the beans aren't soft yet, but pretty close. And then you pressure can them. The pressure canning process is submerging them in pure steam. The longest times, the very, very longest, is 90 minutes, or that I'm aware of, that I can think of. I don't think there are pressure canning times longer than so that said, they're going to continue to cook during that process. Well, not necessarily cooking them, but you're soaking them for sure.
Just to clarify. And
you're not necessarily cooking them. They're definitely soaked. They're definitely soaked. And then let's say you got your soaked beans and you're going to combine them with, I don't know enough about your Instant Pot cooking process to speak to that specifically, but many pressure canning recipes will have you take soaked beans, pre-soaked beans. If you didn't soak them the night before, you can boil them in can't remember for how long, but you boil them in some water to get them kind of caught up to that soaking process. And then you assemble your ingredients, your raw vegetables. I think it is preferable in terms of taste and aesthetics to brown all the sides of your chunks of meat first, and then you assemble everything into your jars, and then you pressure can it. So it is being cooked in the pressure canner. But the assembly is just like when you're cooking supper. You're assembling everything into one pot, probably, usually.
Are you draining the liquid from the beans before canning them?
Okay. Usually. Or draining that soaking liquid and then adding fresh water or bone broth or tomato juice or other liquid. Yeah, you would drain the soaking liquid and then add usually another liquid. Not a ton. Liquid is a great conductor of heat, right?
Okay.
So many pressure canning recipes are going to be fairly wet, like fairly stew or soupy, because it's a great – it transfers heat very well.
Okay.
But that said, you can pressure can brown chunks of meat all day long. That works great, and there's tons of safe directions for doing so.
And then – but we're not salting anything, right? So if it's a savory
you can
dish. Oh, so you can salt it before canning it.
You can add as much salt as you want in canning. Canning has no, there's no negative thing that will happen by adding or removing salt. So that's another dietary concern that people have. That's kind of like late 90s, right? Like cutting out salt. Yeah. But you can add salt as much as you'd like. When you're making pickles, it often calls for pickling salt, which is just salt with no additives, which is preferable for lots of reasons anyway.
Yeah.
So if you're just using Morton's with iodine, your brown might be cloudy. Your brine might be cloudy. But you can add salt to your heart's content.
Do you want, Christine, did you have any other questions?
No, actually, this feels very educational. I feel like I was just in a workshop.
Oh, I'm so glad. I love it. I'm so glad.
Okay. So Jenny, do you want to give people tell people where they can find you,
yeah,
you know, where your podcast is, the name of it, your book. When is your book out yet?
The Pressure Canning Cookbook will be available on April 2nd, 2024. And I'm very excited about it. And it's perfect for a beginner or an intermediate pressure canner who wants to make delicious food for their families. And there's tons of different recipes, all the way from bone broth to Bloody Mary mix to stew, my grandma's hamburger soup recipe, split pea with pork shoulder. There's a ton of great recipes in it. And I think anybody who's interested in pressure canning would love it. I blog at thedomesticwildflower.com.
Christine, you could make like your liver tonic just without the liver part in it and then just open a can every Monday.
I know. I was literally just thinking that when she said Bloody Mary mixture. I'm like, ooh, I'm definitely going to try that.
And then it's easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, this book sounds very appropriate for someone like me.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay. Sorry. Keep going. You blog at?
I blog at thedomesticwildflower.com. My podcast that I host with Anna Cash is called Perfectly Preserved. And my book is The Pressure Canning Cookbook. I'm most active on social media on Instagram, and my handle is at The Domestic Wildflower. Yeah, I think that's it.
Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners?
I just want to invite any listener that's interested in learning about canning to learn, because I think it can just really round out your preserving practice. And it's just one more tool in your toolkit that helps you bring homemade food that of your choosing, of your preparation, that uses you know, ingredients that you feel good about into your home. And I think it's, once you do it a handful of times, it can really be a really fun community builder and friendship builder. It's great to do with friends. One thing that I tried to add in my book was I could try to mention where you could break the recipe into time chunks. Like you can prepare this early on in the day and then complete it later, you know, finish the canning process at another time. I tried to break it up like that so that.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So I just tried to keep in mind, like, people don't usually aren't just home with no interruptions for 8 hours or whatever the case may be. But I tried to include details for working through small chunks of time. But that's it. I thank you so much for having me. It was great chatting with you guys.
Yeah. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for teaching us all about canning.
Absolutely.
All right, everybody. We have our general plug for please go leave a review. And it helps people find the show. And post it on your Instagram if you're listening. Tag us. We'll repost it. Blah, blah, blah. That stuff. And let's see. I think that's all I've got to say. Christine, do you want to say anything else?
No, just to emphasize that when you leave a review, it helps other people learn about the specific episodes or the shows. And we love hearing from our listeners.
All right, guys. That's it.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to Modern Ancestral Mamas. Check out the show notes for the resources. You can find Christine on Instagram at NourishTheLittles and online at nourishthelittles.com. You can find Corey on Instagram at fornutrientsake and online at fornutrientsake.com. Follow us on Instagram at Modern Ancestral Mamas.
The views and opinions expressed in this episode are those of the guests. They do not reflect Corey and I's and Modern Ancestral Mama's personal views and opinions. We do not take responsibility for any ideas expressed during the podcast interview.
The information contained in this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended to be medical advice and should not replace your relationship with your healthcare practitioner.